Mr. Messner, you say climbing has always been more than a sport for you. Danger and difficulty are part of the game. Why are you so attracted to living on the edge?
First of all, I don't say it's more than a sport. It's different from sport. Sport you do for exercising, for measuring yourself with other people. There is numbers involved and competition involved. If you go to climb a mountain, if you really go to climb a mountain and not go in the gymnasium hall to do some plastic climbing, and this is a sport, going in the gymnasium hall where there are artificial walls and many people are climbing, they are beautiful sport, maybe one of the most beautiful sports existing. But going out in nature has to do with danger, has to do with difficulties built by nature. And nature is creative, nature is every day new, nature is changing. And we human beings have to have a knowledge about it. And we have to see where we can move, where we can go up. We have to follow the weather. If the weather is getting bad, we have to go down. And so we are living like human being. We are living maybe 10,000 years ago because we are out of civilization. We are in totally exposure. It means exposure far away from any every possibility to be saved in case of emergency. And you feel the responsibility for yourself and for your partners if you do mountaineering. And I'm interested in the adventure of mountaineering and not in the sport of climbing.
Hmm. Well, you've talked about meeting the mountain. Can you explain what you mean by that?
William Blake, the famous poetry man, said, if man and mountains are meeting, great things are happening. And I am agreeing totally. In our inner feelings, we feel fear, we feel enthusiasm, we feel especially also what the other partner, the other man in the group or the woman in the group is feeling. And I think that we have a possibility going on difficult adventures, on high mountains, on vertical walls, wherever. Also, the Yosemite Valley is a beautiful area for doing adventures. We have the possibility to cope with our partners because in an empathic way, we feel what the others are feeling. Without speaking together, we know exactly what the others are doing, what they are feeling, what they are having in their own mind.
So this is not about having good conversations as you're climbing up the mountain, but it is about relating to the other people who are climbing.
It's relating to the other people, yes, and you don't need a conversation. On the summit of Everest or a little bit before the summit without oxygen bottles, you are so exhausted that you cannot either speak. Right? You don't have the air to speak with another one. But you see and feel and see in the eyes of the others what they are feeling and how they are thinking, how they are behaving, how they are coping with fear, especially. Fear and courage are two very strong elements in our feelings if we climb mountains.
Hmm. Well, to talk about your own life, I mean, to go back a long way, when did you first start climbing?
I started climbing as a small boy. My father brought me on a 9,000 feet peak, 10,000 feet probably, in the Dolomites. And I had only 5 years before I
went
to school.
You were 5 years old and you climbed a 10,000-foot peak?
Yes, I was 5 years old when I climbed a 10,000-foot peak. But
wow.
It is not a difficult climb, but it's a small rock climb, but it's very long. So I suffered under the fatigue because it was not easy. I remember very well reaching the summit, and I was not so impressed by the summit, not either by the fact that I could see down a vertical wall on one side. I was very impressed by the huge world around me because I was living before in a very narrow, small valley. This was my home place. And I could not see more than maybe 10 square kilometers.
And you grew up in the Dolomites in Italy, right?
I grew up in the Dolomites, in one of the most beautiful groups of the Dolomites, in the Geislerspitzen, in German. In Italian, because it's an Italian-German community there. I am part of the German-speaking Italian north of Italy, of South Tyrol. This is a small community which was taken over after the First World War from Austria, and it was part of Italy. And I am still living there in this small country. And we speak German and we speak Italian, but our culture is German. And now, after 100 years, exactly this year is the first 100 years, we are a sum of two cultures, Italy and Germany.
Now, you said that, and you said that your father was the one who took you up on that mountain when you were 5 years old. And he was really the one who taught you to climb, right? But from what you've said, it sounds like you had a really difficult relationship with him. I mean, not just you, but all of your siblings as well. I mean, to the point where he would beat you and your other brothers,
yes,
as well.
Yes, this was normal in this period after the Second World War. And the father was a climber in the 30s before he went to the war. He was with the Germans, I would say, with the Nazis in the war, because they were forced to do it, and especially he was also fascinated by the system, I tell it openly. And all these soldiers, especially the South Tyroleans, they freely went more or less to the war. The history is quite complicated, but to understand our situation, we have to know this. And after the war, most of these soldiers were still young men, but they were not able to understand what really happened. They were not able to speak openly about the guilt, about all the problems they had to overcome, and the problems they also caused during this Second World War. And in our family, only when I was 15, 16, we slowly understood what happened during the war.
That you, and that your then, father, that your father was a Nazi sympathizer, too.
Yes, yes. But yeah. You have to know that 90% of the Germans were Nazi sympathizers, and the South Tyroleans were not in Germany. So we South Tyroleans were Italians in 39. 39 is the beginning of the war. Hitler and Mussolini in 39 made a contract, and they decided the South Tyroleans should be free to vote or to stay in Italy or to go out of the own country and go and join big Germany, the Third Reich. And the tragic fact is that 86% of the South Tyroleans were willing to leave South Tyrol and to move to Germany. So this vote was happening between September and December 39. And Hitler was only thinking about the soldiers he would get out of South Tyrol. And after this option, how it was called, the option between staying in South Tyrol or leaving for Germany, meant that all the people they opted for Germany, they had to go to the Wehrmacht, with Hitler's soldiers. And so they were forced afterwards to go to Russia or wherever. And my father, at the end of the war, was in Italy because he was a very well-speaking Italian, so he was translating for German generals in Italy. When the Americans came from south of Italy to defend Italy from the Wehrmacht,
mm-hmm. So
but
I want to come back.
Is important to understand why a father could so be hard to the children, because he came out of the war, and he did not have the feeling that the whole thing went in the way they were hoping before this option for Italy and Germany. So they were trapped and they had to do these things, and on the end they were not open to their children. And I speak not only for my father, I speak for most of the South Tyrolean families in this period.
Hmm. So you had this very complicated relationship with your father, and yet on the other hand, what he did in terms of climbing, the confidence that he had in you is, I have to say, is kind of astonishing as I was reading about it. I mean, you were pretty young and climbing tall cliffs, sometimes without ropes. I mean, where if you fell, you would die. And you know, and he knew that you were doing that.
Yes. My father helped me to become a very good rock climber up to the 16 years, I would say. He never stopped us. I was not only the only one in the family. We all went to rock climb because he showed us how to handle it. And especially my younger brother Günther and myself, we became really extreme rock climbers.
Well, you were considered among the best rock climbers in Europe, right? I mean, while you were still teenagers.
No, teenagers, no. With 20, I was able to keep up with everybody else, and I learned from the older climbers. And then I was just on my own. When I became 18, 19, my father tried to to stop my rock climbing. He became anxious that I would maybe fall down or maybe not be able to handle my life. Up to the end of his life, my father was always thinking that I will finish as a clochard and I would not be able to handle my practical life. And especially when I bought my castle, I bought a castle in 1883 for nothing because nobody had an interest to have it. And when he read it in the paper that his son bought a castle in near his home village, he said to me, "I will never go to visit you because this is the financial finishing of your life."
He thought you were going to be ruined by buying this castle.
Yes, exactly. Bankrupt. He was thinking I will get bankrupt.
Now, I want to come back to your climbing because you tell one story about when you were 18 and your younger brother Gunther was 16, you climbed the north face of Monte Pelmo, 800 meters
yes.
of vertical rock, and halfway up you were caught in a lightning storm.
Right. It was really dangerous stuff. And that we survived this fact gave us a lot of confidence and a lot of power. We went in this wall. It's one of the big Dolomite walls, maybe same height like El Capitan. Not so difficult like the routes on El Capitan, but one of the big, famous, traditional alpine walls in the Dolomites. And we did easily, not easily, it was not easy because it was partly icy, the rock was partly icy. We went to the halfway up and we got caught in a storm and with snow and lightning and thundering. And we hid it under an overhang for a while. And after a while, the storm was over and we went further because going back meant to go in bigger risk because going down the same wall, stones would come from upside and deeper down we would go, more stones we had to support. So we decided to go up. And we had again, 100 meters below the summit, again a thunderstorm, but much more terrible than before. And we climbed the last 100 meters under the light of lightnings. We had no other light.
But how do you, how can you climb? Is it raining when you were doing this?
No, it was raining partly, but it was snowing on the end. Maybe we had 20 centimeters of snow on the wall.
How do you grip the rock if it's so wet?
You have to, with the naked fingers, you have to get the holds and make them warm so the snow is melting and so you have a grip. It's very difficult. And we had a problem to go down on the other side, on the easy side, because we never climbed this mountain before from the easy side. And always under lightning, we found the route because we had a very strong instinct. And this we learned climbing with the father in very young years. And this is maybe the power I had over the other climbers. I am not a better climber than others. I'm not made for better with my lungs and with my heart than others. But my instinct, which was growing very strongly between my 5th and my 15th birthday, was the key of my successes. And now the first time we could use this instinct and survive in a situation which maybe quite nobody else would have the chance to survive.
When you say your instinct, you're talking about you had a gift for finding the route up the rock.
Yes. But not only the gift for finding the route. This also is instinct. To see from far away with your eyes where there is a small possibility to go left or go right, to use a crack to go further. And this instinct is one thing, but the instinct for the quality of the rock, I could see, I still can see, but also my instinct is not anymore so strong like in the 70s or in the 80s. But anyway, I still have the instinct generally to see from far away where the rock is loose. So I don't go there because this is too dangerous. I can see from far away, I could see from far away, what is the weather doing? So if the weather changed in time, I normally went back. And all these instinct dimensions were helping me to survive. And they give me, especially with the Pelmo North Face, they give me self-conscience. So I know I can survive in very difficult situations. And this was also the power which pushed us far further and further.
Well, the way you write about that experience after you came down Monte Pelmo, you say either you survive or you're dead.
Yes, but this is
I mean, which is sort of maybe a, you know, to put it starkly, but I mean you were right on the edge there, weren't you? I mean, you very easily could have died.
I could easily die. I didn't die there. Both we didn't die there. We were very lucky. But generally, my form of climbing is nothing else than the art of surviving. It's a very schizophrenic thing what we are doing. We extreme mountaineers, we extreme adventurers. We go where the possibility to die is very high for not dying. And since the possibility to die, stonefall, avalanches, cold, high altitude, lack of oxygen, and, since the possibilities are very high to die, the surviving is an art. And it's not a sport, it's an art. And for this art, you need knowledge, you need power, you need experience, and especially you need instinct. The famous climbers, Chris Bonington, for example, or John Ross Kelly, they have all this instinct to see, to feel, to smell the mountain, and to smell the danger. And so they survived, and they did it a whole life long.
So if that threat of death is not very real for you, it's not as exciting? I mean, you don't feel as alive if there is a strong possibility that you could die?
It's also very difficult to say. Many times in my life, I told to myself, now it's enough. Finally, it's enough. But after 3-4 weeks at home or in some work, I'm forgetting about the most dangerous situations. And slowly, a new idea is coming up. And knowing that the last time maybe I was very near to the edge, so I would not anymore go so near to the edge next time, preparing better. Each expedition, each adventure is giving me more knowledge, more know-how. So I'm focusing and nearing the edge always with each activity. And coming out of a situation like the solar center of Everest, the north face of Pelmo, which about we spoke before, is making clear that I survived. And the naked life is still in my property. And the rest is not important. And so it's possible to have a new idea and to follow it, to study the world, to study the possibilities, and to go for the realization. Doing adventuring is nothing else than going in dangerous places to survive, but it's also like having an idea that's a pure fantasy thing and making it real. Hmm. On the end, you have nothing in your hand if you climb a high mountain and you are back. But you had an idea, and this idea became a reality.
Right.
And I call this the golden step. The golden step, to have an idea and to be willing and also able to make it real. And I did many realizations, many, many. And I did nothing else also beside of climbing. Also, my museums I am doing finishing now, they were on the beginning a pure idea, only an idea. And I spoke with my wife, and she said, we will go bankrupt if you do it. Don't do it. And my father was not anymore alive, so he could not say anything. But also my brothers and museums specialists, and also my bankers. I don't have any bankers, but the people that care about my financial life, they said, don't do it. This is impossible to do. Hmm. But I had a strategy, and I had a vision, and the whole thing is functioning. It's functioning very well.
Well, I want to take you back again to a bit earlier in your life. Now, we were talking about what it was like when you were in your 20s, and you and your younger brother, Gunther, were climbing these incredible rocks in the Dolomites. A bit later, when you were in your early 20s, you got into high-altitude mountaineering, first to the Andes, then to the Himalayas, and clearly one of the pivotal experiences of your life was climbing Nanga Parbat, which you describe as the watershed, a demarcation line between your youthful exploits as idealistic, obsessive rock climbers and high-altitude Himalayan mountaineering. What happened on that first trip?
On Nanga Parbat happened exactly what could have happened on Pelmo North Face or in other things. We pushed it to the limits, and we were invited both for the Nanga Parbat Rupal Face. The Rupal Face is the highest wall of the world. It's 3 times the Eiger North Face. It's more or less 5-6 times the wall of El Capitan. Not so difficult, but going up in very high altitude, 8,125 meters.
So this is one of the tallest mountains in the world.
The tallest walls. I think it's the 8th highest mountain of the world, but the vault is the abyss is the highest of the whole world. And we were fascinated by this wall. We didn't go to climb Nanga Parbat. We went to do the wall, the difficult climb. Like in the Dolomites, we went to do the difficult climbs, not the easy ways.
Yeah, and you went with your brother, Günther.
Yes, in a huge expedition with Germans and Austrians and an expedition leader from Germany, non-climber but organizer. The expedition was huge. We had up to the base camp 8 tons of material. We stayed in the wall for 40 days preparing fixed ropes and preparing camps. We did this ascent like the Himalayan style, like everybody else handled it in this year's beginning of the 70s. And on the end, we were in a very tiny situation because we got information from the base camp, the weather will change. We were in the last bivouac. It was not either anymore a camp, it was a bivouac. And in this situation, I decided by myself, and I spoke via radio with the base camp, with the expedition leader, and he was agreeing for the fact that the thing went very tiny. And I said, I would like to try a solo ascent without rope, without nothing. So I'm very quick, and I will go up, if possible, to the summit and back. And the others in the last camp, my brother and a German filmmaker, they should, in the meanwhile, follow me a little bit and leave some ropes so that I could abseil better. And afterwards, we would immediately go down to the base camp for not being trapped by the bad weather. So I started. I remember very well on the 27th of June 70, at 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe 35 below zero, without anything, with gloves naturally and clothes, but no rucksack, no pitons, no rope, nothing. And I could climb quite well. It was possible to do. Nobody touched this part of the wall before. And I did not know what is happening in the rest of the expedition. And when I reached 7,950 meters, more or less 150 meters below the summit, I could see that my brother was following me.
Günther, he was not supposed to be coming up after you, was he?
Not supposed. He decided by himself. He was free to decide like this, but he did not tell me that he will follow me. And I was not either thinking that he would do it, but he did it. So we were in a very precarious situation near the summit. The high difficulties were below us. We had a quite easy ground in front of us. And we did the mistake to go further because we were used to go to the limit. And we went further because we climbed in this moment both, last part solo, the highest wall of the world. But we were interested to reach the summit because the wall was climbed only if we would have gone to the summit. So we went both together, the last piece to the summit. It went easier and easier up to the summit. We reached the summit. My brother became slower. And when we left the summit for going down, it was quite late. It was too late in reality. And the mistake was to go further after the meeting below the summit. So on the way down from the summit, still on the same route where we came up, the last part is easy, I told you, I understood that my brother was not anymore perfectly handling the climbing. He became too slow. He sat down. He didn't go up. I said, we have to go down. We have to be quick. And he was beginning to be high altitude sick for the fact that he was too quick following me. He had to go quicker than me up to the point where we met. And it was not possible, not thinkable, to go down with a high altitude sick person on this vertical wall of Rupal where we came up. And now we were totally trapped and we had to go down somewhere. We were not willing to sit down at 8,000 meters and wait for death.
You had not brought any equipment, any sleeping gear to be able to be overnight on the mountain at that altitude.
We had no bivisack, no sleeping bag, no tent, no cooker, no food, nothing. And we went down a little bit on the other side of the mountain where it's not so steep. But we did not know if we would have a chance to go down to the base of the mountain because we could not see from up, it was only abyss on all sides. So we took a place and we stayed for a whole night. It was the most terrible night I ever had. It's a miracle that we both survived. And in the morning we were quite stiff, but after a while we were able to move again. And we tried to go down on the other side. And we went down, but in a very strange staffette system. I went ahead looking for a route. My brother was following. If I give him a sign, come over. If I could not go further because a vertical abyss was in front, below me, I had to go back, look left, look right. And so slowly...
Because you said that Gunther didn't have the energy to go down and then to come back up if the route wasn't
exactly
the right one.
He was too sick to do a double and triple way on the way down. So in this system, we were able to go down and we did a second bivouac in the middle of the wall. It was not so dangerous anymore and not so cold, but anyway, in the meanwhile, we were frozen. In the meanwhile, we were very, very tired. And on the third day, always without water and without food, we reached the base of the wall, the Diamir wall, exactly the opposite side of the mountain. And there was a big problem to reach the green areas, the green meadows. We could see the green meadows below us, but between us and the green meadows of the Diamir Valley, there was a glacier, a broken glacier with hundreds of crevasses. And without a rope, it was very dangerous to go in these crevasses. And we understood we have to look left or right to find a way going around these crevasse areas. And again, I said to my brother, wait, maybe half an hour, 20 minutes. I will see if I can surround these crevasses. And during my searching to find a way out of this dangerous situation, he was cut by an avalanche. And I went back after a while, searching for him, but I could not take away the ice blocks because it was an ice avalanche.
Had you known that he had been caught in an avalanche?
I could see it when I came back because on the place where he had to be, he was not anymore my brother. It was all new snow and all new ice blocks. And some avalanches came in this time when I was below of him. You have to know that this Serac area, where the crevasses were, this is quite like a hill. So I could not, after 5-10 minutes, look back to my brother because there was a hill above me, between he and me. So I could not see exactly what's happening there. Only when I came back, because he didn't come to follow me, when I yelled and said, Come, it's okay, we can find a way. I found the way out of the difficult situation. And in this moment, I was very schizophrenic. I did not know 100% that brother is under this avalanche. But there was no other solution. And so I had on one side always the feeling my brother is somewhere. I also had the feeling he's yelling somewhere. The whole night I was looking and hoping and sleeping because I was so tired and waking up again and having the feeling my brother is somewhere and afterwards knowing that my brother is under the avalanche. I became, I would say, totally crazy.
And by that point you probably figured that your brother was dead.
No, I knew it. But there was still between the knowledge and the feeling was a difference. I had the feeling that my brother is still there. And I had the knowledge that he died. And next day when I went down and finally I reached the first green areas, I could see horses coming to help me. But when I reached the place where the horses were standing, there was not horse, there was a stone. And again I had the vision that people came to help me. And I went a little bit more and I could see this is not a man, but this is a maybe a plant.
So you were hallucinating at that point.
I was hallucinating for many, many hours. And still, on the end, the instinct helped me to find the right way because the valley was empty. There was no people. There was nobody. The instinct helped me to find the right way through glaciers, through moraines, through woods on the end. So I came to a meadow where a few families were sitting, and they did not understand who I am, and they did not understand why somebody can come down from a mountain on which he did not go up. I didn't pass this valley for going to Nanga Parbat. So for them, I appeared from heaven, but not as a holy man, as a broken down man.
And you were near death at that point yourself, weren't you?
I was very near to death, yes. I had many unconscious hours or moments during this going down. I could not either hike, I could not walk. I crawled down from the mountain. For the fact that I had so bad injuries, it means frostbitten feet, and the feet they swollen up so big that I could not anymore take the shoes on.
And didn't you have 7 of your toes amputated after that because of the frostbite?
After this, yes. I went home and they amputated 7 toes, yeah, and some fingertips.
Do you feel any responsibility for your brother's death?
I feel the whole responsibility. All the responsibility is mine, because he's not anymore alive. We divided responsibility during our activity, but afterwards I am the only one who survived. So the whole responsible is going to the survivor. Nobody else had any responsibility. And for this it's not either understandable why certain persons later on, still now, try to discuss this thing and saying they have nothing to do with it. They have nothing to do with it. This is my responsibility, and it's my story, and especially my fault, because we went further in a moment when maybe today I would not go further. But I am openly saying we were 25. I was 25. My brother was 24. We were like the famous Siegfried. You know who is Siegfried in the Wagner stories?
Yeah.
And we felt that we can do everything and we will survive, because we survived the most dramatic situations in the Dolomites, in Mont Blanc area, wherever. We did a new line on the Eiger Wall, and not on the wall, on the pillar on the left side. And we had this instinct to go step by step further. But on Nanga Parbat, we went too far, especially because both of us went on the end as solo climbers, not thinking that in the moment of a breakdown of one of us, without a rope and without a tent, there are small possibilities to survive.
Yeah,
there's
something that you say when you have talked about this tragedy. You've written, "It is through resisting death that we humans experience what it is to be human." Which is kind of an astonishing thing to say. I mean, it sounds like you're saying if we don't risk death, we're not fully experiencing what it means to be human.
If somebody is not knowing, as a child you don't know, but that we are dying, and with our birth we are dying human. And only if we know that we are limited in our life, we are strong in living. I'm sure about this. And I have to say, the most dramatic situations of my life I had on Nanga Parbat, the story I told you now in a few words. It was the hardest thing I had to support and to go through, but it was the most important moment of my life, because really I was dying. The death was the simplest thing. I had the feeling now it's over, and I forgot about myself, and I became unconscious, and I woke up again because I had this last part of energy, and I went further. But I had the experience to quite die. I did not die, because otherwise I would not be here. But death is the key of life after birth. We are lucky or not lucky to be born. I feel that I was lucky to be born, also in this family, also with the difficulties we had as children. But the fact that I became a very strong realizer of ideas has to do that with 25 I knew that life is limited. And I was trying to fill it up day by day, second by second, year by year.
Did that experience on Nanga Parbat, losing your brother, nearly dying yourself, did that change you in some way? Were you a different person after that?
My first life was over, and I begin a few months later a second life. You have to understand that my brothers and my parents, they tried to stop me finally and said, finish your studies and forget about mountaineering. The expedition leader just in Pakistan, seeing my toes, he was a doctor, said, you will never anymore climb. And I was a while unhappy, and I had to cope with this tragedy because the responsibility was mine. And after a few months, I understood that if I would quit with mountaineering, I understood that rock climbing will not anymore be possible like before. I lost a lot of possibilities with losing my toes. And after a while, I understood if I would quit and I would do something else, I would become an unhappy person because there were many common visions and dreams in my brothers and my mind before having this tragedy. And now these dreams were still in my mind, and I could cope better with my brother. He was dead, but he was still in my mind if I would go further. And from this moment on, I became a high-altitude climber.
And you became famous for a number of remarkable feats. I mean, the first person to climb all 14 of the world's 8,000-meter mountains, the first to climb Everest without supplemental oxygen, the first to solo Everest. I mean, was that the drive for you to be the first to do all these different things?
First, I had the double energy because I got also the energy of my brother. I could go with him in my mind, not in reality. I found the best climbers of Middle Europe as partners, like Peter Haberla or Hans Kammerlander later. And I had in the meanwhile a knowledge about climbing history, and I could learn from other climbers to find new ideas. And in the second part of my life, I was able to, it was also in the middle, in the strongest period of my life, I could realize quite all the dreams I had in my mind. I'm a strong dreamer. In the first life, I did not do all the first ascents I had in my mind. More than half I was not able to do because I lost my toes too early. And after this period, climbing all the 8,000-meter peaks and climbing in Antarctica and climbing in Africa and climbing all over the world, I learned also to be self-sufficient economically. So I was not anymore dependent on an expedition leader. I was able to finance all my expeditions. I learned to handle it also practically as a storyteller, as a writer, as a lecturer. And when I climbed Everest in a solo ascent in the monsoon time and on a partly new route, I understood now I overcome the possibilities. I could not go higher, and I could not go in more extreme situations, at least for me, because more high difficulties I could not do. My possibilities in the second life to do very difficult rock and ice pieces were limited for my loss of the toes. And when I reached the maximum in this second life, expressing myself on the highest peaks of the world, I decided, in this case, not because I was forced, I decided freely to change life again, and I became an adventurer in the huge deserts.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that, because, I mean, you've talked about how you've had these sort of almost different chapters of your life, and I suppose we could say the third chapter of your life was doing these remarkable adventures, not at high altitude, but across vast expanses. You walked across the Gobi Desert, and perhaps most astonishingly, you walked across Antarctic. You walked across the Antarctic on foot, across the South Pole, pulling a sled for 2,800 kilometers.
Yes.
How was that different than climbing up a mountain, other than it takes a lot longer?
It is an adventure of a different kind. There is not so high difficulties. There is danger for the storms. The storms are much stronger than on the Himalayas. And there is also some crevasses. But also danger is not like on K2 or like on Mount Everest. But the exposure, being out of civilized world, is much bigger. In Antarctica, in the Gobi Desert is not so bad because partly people are living there. In Greenland, the long way, how we did it. The exposure is so big that you feel like on the moon. And this is great. To be apart from everything. I did not hear about my family for altogether 4 months.
Without contact with other people, except for your one partner.
Yeah, on the pole we had contact with other people because you know that on the pole is a station with scientists and technicians. And in the summertime, we reached it on the last day of the year, 89. So people were there and we could speak with them. And the technicians were very nice to us and they helped us. They gave me a possibility to take a shower. Because we had not possibilities to do a shower in 3 months.
What was the hardest part of that Antarctic trip?
The hardest part was to pull the sledge. It is very hard because the sledges were heavy. We were in two, Arvid Fuchs and myself. And the snow is so cold, 35, 40 below Celsius, that there is friction. And you walk like an animal to pull the sledge. Going without a sledge in Antarctica is like enjoying.
Wait, is like what?
Enjoying. Joy.
Uh-huh. Wait, that was fun?
But pulling the sledge is not a fun. It's not fun. This is hard. This is very hard because the friction between the snow and the sledge is so high.
Yeah. You clearly are a very driven man. I mean, obsessed, some people
would
say.
No, I'm obsessed. You can say obsessed. I don't think that I'm driven.
Of course you're driven. Yeah, you've said, you're remarkably driven.
I have strong ideas. Still now. now I'm doing books. There are so many stories in adventuring which are not yet written. There are many ideas to make real. I am nothing else than a real maker of ideas.
But I mean, you're also pretty upfront about how there were trade-offs in what you did. I mean, your first marriage fell apart because you were gone so much. There were long stretches when you didn't see your children. Do you have any regrets about those choices you made?
No. Now, for this, no. Because I think that I had the same time with the children like other fathers. With the difference, other fathers are leaving maybe at 7 o'clock in the morning and they come home at 8 o'clock in the evening. And I was at home for months and afterwards I was gone for months. And the children, they tell it, now they are bigger, so they tell it openly and said they were never afraid. They were always sure the father is coming back. And I have to be thankful to two women. They saved my possibilities. My mother always let me go. You have to imagine, my brother was 16, I was 18, and we started at 4 o'clock in the morning, and she prepared breakfast for us. And she did not know if it would come in the evening, because we started with the ropes and we went. And she knew that we do these crazy things. But she never in her life said, don't do it. Only on the end, when I finished with the 8,000 meter peaks, before doing the last two, she came and said, if you are able to do them all, I understand you have to do all of these mountains. But if you did them all, promise me that's over. And so I said, okay. And I keep the promise. And when I became an adventurer for flat areas, she did not really understand. And I remember very well when I started the Greenland expedition, I went with a brother. He's a doctor because I was just 50 and slowly brokeable. And I said, I would need now a doctor. And he said, let me go. I like to go. He's a very good skier. He's a marathon runner. He's a climber, but not a professional one. And when I went to my mother and told her, now we will go, my Hubert is his name, and we will go on to cross Greenland, she said, ah, finally he has holidays, because he's working so hard, so it's good for him that he has holidays in Greenland. So she was not anymore afraid. She was afraid that we would fall down, but she did never block me.
Now you said there were two women who have made this possible.
My wife, Sabine, she, the mother of three children, she never keep me down at home when I had an idea of doing this and that. And she understood that this is my life. And she took responsibility. We are living in a matriarchat, if you know what this is.
A matriarchy.
So she's deciding. She's deciding. She is caring about also the financial side of our family.
I am a free man.
I'm a totally free man to do the most crazy things of the world.
Thanks to the women. I have to ask then. You have several kids. I mean, have you taught them to climb?
I have four kids.
Have they taken on these kinds of risks that you did when you were younger?
My son is a very good rock climber now. He's going also on ice. It's very difficult for me to see it, but I accept it. I have to accept it. And for a while, I was very... I know what he's doing, and I know what can happen, but I cannot stop him. I will not stop him. He's studying. He will surely not be a professional climber, because he understood that he would be under too big pressure. But he has partly the same philosophy. He's doing exactly what other people are doing today, going in the chimney hall to train, going to the Klettergarten. This is the smaller mountains, smaller rocks where they do very difficult things. But in generally, he likes adventure alpinism. And from time to time, he invites me to come with him. He's climbing much better than me, so I can follow him. I'm happy about to divide experience with my own son. But he's doing risky things. I understand perfectly that he loves to do it, and he's doing it. And if I say, you know, this is dangerous, be careful there. Normally, he's also saying to me, Papa, don't speak this bullshit. You know exactly what you did, and I do what I have to do.
you're 70 years old now, right?
I'm 70 years old, yes.
So obviously you cannot do certain kinds of climbs that you did when you were younger, and you have various other projects, including overseeing these various mountaineering museums you've started. But do you feel something's missing now? I mean, does your life seem smaller now than it used to?
No. I accept totally that the mountains are getting higher for me, the walls are getting steeper. I can do middle difficulties in the Dolomites. I can still go on a 6,000-meter peak. But I am not regretting the fact that I'm getting older. I did my stuff. I did my high-altitude climbing, my adventuring, and my Dolomite climbing. And I found, and about this I'm very lucky, very happy, I found new challenges. And I found out that the system to overcome in the realization between idea and fact, I handle like I handled before a Dolomite climb. The museum became a new challenge, and I did it. First, I was planning for 3-4 years. I was preparing, I was looking for the money, and afterwards, step by step, since 15 years, I did only this. I invest all my money, all my time, all my enthusiasm in this project, and it is functioning. And I say to everybody in the world, if somebody is taken with enthusiasm by an idea, he will always be successful and do it. Maybe not in the first time, maybe in the second, fourth try. And I failed many, many times. Alone on the 8,000-meter peaks, I had 13 failures. And I learned through the failures, and I tried again and again and again. And normally when I am on my knees, I try to get up again and go a step further.
This is just a remarkably inspiring story that that you have told us. Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you very much.